In any event, whether these things happen in accordance with laws human, feral, or divine, it is clear that they do happen. At any given time, some nations want change and some oppose it. It is natural, moreover, that people tend to see much merit in the condition in which they find themselves or in that to which they aspire. Those who want change speak well of youth and vigor and manifest destiny and the dead hand of the past. Those who prefer things as they are hold law and order in the highest esteem. And the irreverent diplomatist whom I knew in Europe in the remote epoch before the Second World War used to say that the wealthy, satisfied powers which had acquired all the empire they could handle and now cherished the status quo should adopt the motto, "Quiet is requested for the benefit of those who have retired." Basic in all this is the fact that nature abhors a political vacuum just as it abhors any other kind, and weakness creates or constitutes a vacuum, and strength will always and forever tend to move into such a vacuum. Weakness is an intolerable provocation to strength. It is this that Edmund L. Taylor had in mind when he wrote that all the lambs of the world have all the sins of all the lions on their consciences. Peace and security are possible only when there is a safe distribution of strength or power, and power is safely distributed only when it is fairly widely and fairly equally diffused, and there are no important vacuums. Many corollaries essential to the appraisal of everyday developments in world politics follow from these basic principles. Thus, it obviously follows, for example, that isolationism is a hallucination. There is and can be no such thing. We cannot escape history. We cannot choose whether or not we will play a part in world politics. We can only choose whether to play a wise and therefore a safe part, or a part which is foolish and therefore dangerous alike to ourselves and to everybody else. Whatever we do, we play a part. The absence of a constitution is also a sort of a constitution, a great French political scientist has said. And similarly, the absence of a policy is also a policy. There is no such thing as a do-nothing policy, for doing nothing amounts to doing something very important indeed. In foreign politics, the passivity of power constitutes action, Maurer writes. To do nothing is to move, not to intervene, when one's intervention would prove decisive, is a form of intervention. This is what Sproul Braden meant by negative intervention. It is something akin to what we mean by the old saw, silence gives assent. It follows also from the essential nature of world politics that foreign policy must take precedence over domestic politics. For foreign policy determines, insofar as a people's destiny is in its own hands, whether a nation shall survive or not, and if so, subject to what conditions. Only if the nation does survive, and only if it does so on conditions permitting of some freedom of action, can there be any scope for domestic debate and decision, can there be, that is, any domestic politics. Every nation in the world, past and present, has had to learn at one point or another in its history of the supremacy of foreign over domestic affairs, a writer in Barron's Weekly has pointed out. The latter, that is, domestic affairs, the latter, it is true, are very direct, visible, and immediate in their impact on the lives of the people. And for that reason, they absorb a large part of public attention. However, the really decisive events, although their effect is often delayed, are almost always those which affect the relationship with other nations. It is foreign policy that makes history. It follows further from the essential nature of world politics that the problems with which they confront us are not as easy as we should like to think they are, and that the methods required for dealing with them are not such as we often consider them to be. Once again, the Secretary of State has put the point better than I could hope to do. Speaking to still another university audience, the Secretary once said of the task of accomplishing the purposes of American foreign policy, "It is a long and tough job, and one for which we as a people are not particularly suited. We believe that any problem can be solved with a little ingenuity and without inconvenience to the folks at large. We have troubleshooters to do this. And our name for problems is significant. We call them headaches. You take a powder and they are gone." These pains about which we are talking, I'm still quoting the Secretary, these pains about which we are talking are not like that. They are like the pain of earning a living. They will stay with us until death. We have got to understand that all our lives, the danger, the uncertainty, the need for alertness, for effort, for discipline, will be upon us. This is new to us. It will be hard for us. But we are in for it. And the only question is whether we shall know it soon enough. There are, as we have seen, no final solutions to the problems of world politics. There is only a constant, unremitting process of trying to keep them within manageable proportions and then managing them. There are only temporary adjustments which must constantly be readjusted, temporary arrangements which must be constantly rearranged. The struggle for survival never ends, except as it may end for one or another participant as that participant ceases to survive. An eminent British historian has been quoted as saying that the Western world may have 50 years of Cold War with the Soviet Union to look forward to. But there is always a Cold War. If not with the Soviets, then with somebody else. It is inescapable in the nature of things that this should be so. Eternal vigilance really is the price of liberty, or at least a down payment on the price, a prerequisite condition. Many other consequences result inexorably from the essential nature of world politics. Let us consider, however, only one more. Now, let us consider why it is that, under most circumstances, the victorious allies in a great war must necessarily and inescapably tend, as soon as the war is won, to turn against each other, and at the same time set about building up their former enemies as speedily as may be possible. What is the position at the end of a war? The position is that the victors have, by definition, imposed their will on the vanquished. The victors have, in greater or lesser degree, a monopoly of power, unless, of course, there be powerful states which have remained neutral. That is, the only state which is strong enough to be a danger to a victor is another victor. More than this, since power in relation to others' power is the only means of safety, each of the victors must now immediately seek to increase its own power relative to that of the other victors, for each of the victors is now potentially dangerous to each of the others. And one of the means by which each will undertake to do this is by seeking new allies wherever they can be found. And one of the obvious places they can be found is among the ranks of the just defeated enemies. It may be that this formulation will strike some of you as too sordid, too squalid, too cynical. If so, let us put it in another way. We have seen that the only safe distribution of power is one which is fairly widely and evenly diffused. And after decisive war, power is concentrated in the hands of the victors, and there are power vacuums among the vanquished. This, as we have seen, is unsafe. Therefore, it is necessary to strengthen the vanquished. This formulation amounts, in its consequences, I submit, to the same thing. Count Rumyantsev, the Imperial Russian Chancellor at the time of John Quincy Adams, when John Quincy Adams was our minister in St. Petersburg, used to say that one of the first rules of diplomacy must be, always love your friend as though one day he might be your enemy, and always hate your enemy as though one day he might become your friend. Edgar Maurer goes beyond this to the heart of the matter and puts it more succinctly too. Today's friend may, almost inevitably will, be tomorrow's enemy, he writes. If these, then, are some of the propositions and corollaries of world politics, how do they manifest themselves in American foreign policy today? The purpose of our foreign policy is so to order our relations with other countries as to enable the Republic to maintain its territorial integrity and independence of action, to remain at peace, to prosper, and to preserve its domestic freedom. I list these objectives in what I take to be their order of priority. I take it, that is, that the nation will sacrifice its domestic freedoms to preserve its prosperity, its peace, and its territorial integrity and independence of action. It will sacrifice its freedom and its prosperity to remain at peace and preserve its territorial integrity and independence of action. It will sacrifice everything else, freedom, prosperity, and peace, to preserve itself against a foreign danger. The nation will do these things, that is, if it is to survive. And I put it to you that it is doing all these things on a truly formidable scale at this very moment. Thus, once again, you will note, foreign affairs must take precedence over domestic affairs. And once again, it is strength or power which is our primary concern, the strength to survive. Everything else must be subordinated to this. How does the United States go about serving the purposes of the national foreign policy? It does so today primarily by trying to reestablish a safe distribution of power throughout the world. That is, one in which power is diffused as evenly as possible among the largest possible number of states. It seeks to fill the dangerous power vacuums in the world, which are, as the Secretary of State has said, an almost irresistible temptation to the Soviets. More particularly, and if you like, more selfishly, the United States seeks to increase its own strength. It seeks to increase the strength of other allied, friendly, and potentially friendly states, and it seeks to prevent the Soviets and their friends and allies from becoming any stronger than they are now, and, whenever possible, to weaken them. The United States seeks to do these things because its side is dangerously weak and the Soviet side is dangerously strong for our survival. Let us particularize further. Let us consider how American policy seeks to accomplish these purposes in certain areas which are of particular interest to our inquiry. Let us consider first Asia. Remember that line in the Noel Coward comedy? The brittle couple are engaging in bright drawing room conversation, and somebody says something about Asia, and the other character says, big place, Asia. It is a big place. We'll see what we can do with it. So much to accomplish in so little time. Speaking very generally, much of Asia after the Second World War was a power vacuum. The conflict had wrought terrible havoc in Asia itself, and it had weakened the so-called Western imperial colonial powers to such a point that they could no longer maintain the rule which they had long exercised in the Far East. The peoples of Asia were seething with long-suppressed aspirations to individual and national betterment. Still speaking very generally, world communism has undertaken to fill this vacuum with its own peculiar form of imperialism. And the United States has undertaken to fill it with valid, vital, viable, indigenous societies, which America has encouraged and helped to be born, to achieve their national freedom, and to develop and mature. Both sides have won significant victories, at least provisional victories, in this contest. Most notably, perhaps, communism has won in China, and the United States has won in the Philippines, in Japan, and in Indonesia. Chiang Kai-shek, the chosen instrument of American policy in China, the man who, America hoped, could lead the Chinese in building up a viable, authentic Chinese society, Chiang has been unable, with such assistance as the United States has given him, to compete successfully with Chinese and Soviet communism. On the other hand, indigenous societies which show promise of viability are developing in Japan, the Philippines, and Indonesia. India, Pakistan, Burma, Ceylon, and Siam, too, are, of course, free. There are stalemates in Indochina and Malaya, and for the time being in Korea. Stalemates maintained with difficulty and only by military intervention of the West. The longer these stalemates last, the worse is the outlook for the development of healthy local societies. The struggle for Asia doubtless will continue indefinitely in one form or another. There are no final victories in this contest, as we have seen. It is permissible to note, however, that the Western world still retains control of the most powerful single national factor in the Far East, Japan, just as it still retains the most powerful in Europe, Western Germany. How is the United States trying to deal with the situation which confronts it in the Far East today? American policy in Asia is caught in a curious conflict between the strategy Washington wishes to employ and the tactics it feels it must. In the long run, the purpose of American policy must be to retain or to acquire the friendship of, or at the very least to achieve the peaceful and mutually beneficial coexistence with, the largest possible number of independent national societies among the Pacific powers, and perhaps particularly the greatest of these, for example, China and India. Yet because of the demands of the more immediate situation, the United States is pursuing shorter-term policies which are alienating India and making the chances of a reconciliation with China much more remote every day. It could be said, at least as accurately, that India and China are pursuing policies which are alienating the United States. But I have preferred to treat this whole subject from the point of view of American policy, not from the points of view of the policies of other countries. There is no necessary incompatibility between the short-term and the long-term American policies. Washington, indeed, thinks that the tactics which now outrage China and offend India are those which are best suited to winning their cooperation in the long run. It seems to Washington, moreover, that this country has little choice as to the policies it may pursue in the Far East for the time being. The United States must oppose aggression in Korea and must insist that other members of the United Nations join America in doing so. If the United States and the United Nations fail to do this, then there is little or no hope of collective security anywhere. And it is a case of soap you put and the devil take the hindmost.